everyone. Welcome to the 315th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
We are going to be talking about Will.i.am's new face mask. For once, we're not talking about Wink and Will.i.am. Yay! We'll be talking about Ring and a robot that uses RF frequencies to detect things. We've got Apple launching an app for Find My, well, other things. We've got Verizon working with AWS for edge computing. Another hack on a water security plant, although this one is older. And Madam A is getting dressed up for the corporate life. Plus, IKEA and Sonos have a new product coming out. Google Home is tweaking some of its settings. And Kevin has reviewed the Wyze Watch, and we'll find out what he thinks about that. Plus, this week we welcome back DigiCert as a sponsor, and our guest is Jennifer Ploskina of Eaton. And Eaton makes electrical boxes, panels, switches, and even stuff for industrial motors and such. And so we're going to be talking about the concept of every home and building becoming its own little microgrid and what that's going to mean. So let's kick this show off with a message from another one of our sponsors. We've got a new sponsor this week. It is Qt. IoT projects can come with lots of challenges. Connectivity, big data analytics, deploying sensors, creating crisp and responsive user interfaces on a tiny footprint are all difficult. Qt, which y'all would recognize as the letters Q and T together, can help with all of that. Qt is the software development platform that has everything you need to create connected devices that your users are going to love. From no-code UI design tools to libraries, sensor APIs, networking, and connectivity classes and protocols that are surprisingly easy to use. Give Qt a try. To learn more about Qt, visit www.qt.io/StaceyOnIoT. Whew, that's a lot of letters. Let's do that one more time. It is www.qt.io/StaceyOnIoT. All right. First up, let us talk about this crazy mask that Honeywell and Will.i.am designed. This is a $300 face mask that looks like something Mad Max would wear.
I was just going to say the same thing.
I mean, it's called the Zuper Mask with an X. Mm-hmm. And one, I'm hoping that we're actually reaching the end of the pandemic soon. So spending $300 on a mask is not something I'm after, but...
Well, it would not surprise me since Asian countries have long worn masks, even pre-pandemic, if more people around the world do wear masks all the time. But I don't think we need what he's providing here.
Let's talk about this. This is a mask with... It looks very hardware future-esque. It's got a Honeywell HEPA filtration system. Now, does HEPA kill all viruses? No.
No.
But it does have noise-canceling headphones, LED lights for the nighttime, rechargeable battery, and Bluetooth. So this lets you basically talk on the phone, take calls. It has a seal over your nose to help your glasses from fogging up. Yay?
This to me is technology for the sake of technology. I mean, I don't want to have to charge my mask when I leave the house. This is something you're going to wear when you know you want to take phone calls on Bluetooth or you want to listen to music and you literally want just the eyes of your face showing because it's all encompassing on your face.
Here's a thought. What if this isn't for like walking to the grocery store? What if this is for like when you're working in an office and you have to have your mask on all day? Does that change things? I mean, because the noise-canceling headphones part or like sitting on an airplane.
Yeah, those use cases make sense. But I mean, I don't take phone calls if I'm in the office, unless they're office phone calls. And that I probably wouldn't be using my mobile phone for that. I don't know. I haven't worked in the office in ages, but
I'm trying to think of this as like, so for example, I have multiple pairs of headphones. I have my noise canceling over the ear headphones that I wear on planes because they're more comfortable and they do a better job, I think.
Same.
I have my Bluetooth headphones that I wear for like working out and they're wireless. I have a special set of headphones for like my business calls and like television type appearances. So I look a little less crazy. Then I have like my cheap earbuds that I keep it in my car. So if I think about the fact that I have four sets of headphones, do I need a fifth that would add basically the ability to be safe on a plane? And maybe if I went to an office in an office, then I might do it. I was prepared to poo-poo this, but now I'm like, oh, maybe I would.
I don't know. I mean, yes, it would work for that. I think you're atypical. I don't think most people have four or five pairs of wireless headphones or headphones in general. Two, maybe three at most. Let me ask you this question. Knowing what this looks like, let's say that we start having events again and you're going to be on stage and you still want to be safe, so you want to wear a mask. Well, you wouldn't be wearing headphones. I don't know. I see this as a very limited type use case. I really do. I mean, I'd rather just use the headphones I have and my N95 mask.
Well, and there's lots of professions that use N95 masks prior to like the pandemic, right? So not just medical, but like paint stripping, and those people might want headphones. I don't know. Or during wildfire season when I wear my N95 all the time.
But what's stopping them from wearing headphones with the mask now?
Okay, that's a good point.
That's what I'm saying. This is just a conglomeration of things, and he's hoping to sell it for $300, and he's got a big name behind it with Honeywell, and I can appreciate that. But when I look at all of the things that he has tried to create, other than helping to form Beats Music, all of his products, can you name them? Most people can't. You might be able to. But
wink, because I want it to work, and it doesn't.
Yeah, he bought Wink, but he created smart jewelry. Zupermask, I think, will go the same way. I just do. Perhaps in a country that wears these all the time, even when it's not a pandemic. Let's see if this takes off in Asia. Then maybe.
All right, we'll see.
$300. Blah. I mean, you look like a Tusken Raider from Star Wars in this thing.
It has an aesthetic, and that aesthetic is the future is very dystopian. The future sucks. Okay. Speaking of the future, let's talk about one of my favorite futuristic smart home technologies, radar. Ring is adding radar. It added it to the video doorbell that we talked about a while back, and now it's adding it to its floodlight cam just to let you have a better view of your home and
see the route that somebody takes to get to your home.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, I don't know what else to say. It's good for that. And it will also hopefully, I'm kind of hopeful that this might help reduce false positives. Like a tree branch eventually, right? A tree branch moving is like, motion. And then you might get an alert. But if you could combine something like motion, but did it come from, like, was there motion over an extended period of time changing position in relation to your house, which could be a person as opposed to a tree branch, which usually just blows in a pretty prescribed direction.
Right. And in a small space, I mean, a tree branch is only going to move maybe a foot at most in either direction or many directions, whereas a person would move several feet and you can track their path. And that would be more of a true sighting of something that you want to see.
Yeah. So I'm just thinking, like, how can we combine this to like make it better?
They're getting there. So this is $250. You can pre-order it starting today. Comes out on May 6th. And they also have a new video doorbell 4 for $200, but that's, I don't think that has the radar.
Oh, boo. All right. And we're not actually speaking of radar again, but we're speaking more of RF, radio waves, which radar is one. MIT researchers have figured out a way to help robots see better by using RF to help them see through things. So think of it like X-ray vision. And instead of Superman-like skills or the ability to see beneath people's clothes, woo, I'm channeling my inner teen boy here. This allows robots to pick things up that are under other things, which is really exciting for like use in a warehouse. Because when you have a warehouse, you've got all sorts of things stacked on top of each other, and a robot might be looking for a particular shape. It can see through something to see if that shape's in there and help get to that. So this is part of an ongoing effort, two trends. One, giving robots the ability to work in more places and more capabilities. And two, using RF in ways, it's really RF plus machine learning or RF plus algorithms, to understand what's going on in an environment. So to give that context. So I was really excited to see this. This is brand new research. It is probably not going to be in real production for a long time. And it's called RF Grasp, if you want to check this out. It's pretty sweet.
that whole RF sensing or positioning of things that maybe you couldn't see optically. We've even seen that to some degree in the smart home, where there are devices that are detecting when somebody falls, and that person may even be in a different room, but the RF signals that pass back and forth through somebody and through the wall can detect, hey, that person isn't where they were, they're now on the floor. It's very early, I think, but it shows a lot of promise.
Yeah, and actually, the researchers working on this, trying to make it relevant for you and I, they said, hey, you can imagine a robot that can find your keys, whether they're under a couch cushion or someplace else. You could be like, my Roomba is named Terrence. So I could be like, Terrence, go find my keys. And lo and
behold. How did you come up with Terrence, might I ask?
We have a history in my house of strange names, and I try to do two-syllable names because that's easier for my voice assistants to work with. Dogs and voice assistants, naming conventions stay the same.
Okay.
I really like saying, hey, G, go tell Terrence to vacuum the master bedroom.
And Terrence says, hey, G, I don't feel like it. Tell Stacy.
Terrence has never talked back to me. Terrence is amazing. All right. Apple.
Speaking of finding out where things are, Apple, which already has the Find My iPhone, my Mac, my AirPods, etc., we know that they've been working on presumably called something called AirTags, which are little tracking devices that you can attach to things. But they're also opening up their Find My platform, so to speak, to made for iPhone licensees. There's now a new Find My certification software application that developers can use to get certification for their devices. So this is big because, for many reasons, Apple probably has the largest amount of devices, mobile devices in consumer hands with UWB or ultra wideband technology. That's their Apple U1 chip. The AirTags are likely to work with that. You can already use that technology with the Apple HomePod Mini and an iPhone for handing off music and such. But they also have NFC to use for finding things and connecting things. They'll use Wi-Fi. They'll use Bluetooth. Regardless, this is a good thing for developers to get in on this platform. Granted, it's not going to help any Android users and other people. But again, Apple has a large user base.
I hate it. And I hate it.
I know you do. I really understand it. And I think it's more because of Apple as a company than Apple as their products that you hate it, correct?
I hate it because tying it to UWB, and yes, they opened up the UWB chip. So it's their U1 chip that uses ultra wideband. Yes. So they open that up, like trackers can put that chip now into their devices and then they can work in this ecosystem. But if I have, like, we're a mixed household, Android and iPhone, you know, now I've got to have a tile for my Android. I mean, it's still going to work on Bluetooth, so that'll be fine, but it's not as granular. So it's just Apple just screwing the nails in, twisting them in, I guess. I don't know.
What they do is make very compelling features that are easy to use, understandable, and appear, in quotes, magical. I'm not saying they are.
They're proprietary to their system.
That is correct. They have built a whole ecosystem, hardware, software, and services that generally works really well. If you don't like it and you don't want to be tied in, I totally, totally, totally understand that. I get like that and I switch between iOS and Android, you know, every 6 months or whatever for that very reason. But then when I'm on Android, I'm like, why doesn't this just work? Why doesn't that just work? I go back because the other things, they do work well. I'm not going to convince you. I'm not trying to. I'm just saying, I think this is a good thing for Apple and its ecosystem.
Yeah. I mean, basically, the MFI program is historic. It's also revenue generating for Apple.
Sure.
It's now part of MFI. It's called Find My Certification Assistant. And yeah, you can pop a U1 chip in your device, certify your device on this, and suddenly people can find their sunglasses with their iPhone, not just like they're in this address or, oh, they're in this general vicinity, but like, oh, they are like 6 inches away from your HomePod. Yay. All right. People with iPhones will no longer need to look for their keys. Good for them.
Are you the only one without iOS in your home?
My daughter usually gets just whoever's phone gets cast off first.
Okay.
So she switches.
Gotcha.
Okay. Let's talk about mechs. No, let's not ever call it that. Let's just call it edge computing. So back in 2019, Amazon Web Services and Verizon teamed up and they were like, hey, we're going to work together for edge computing. So we're going to tie some Amazon services. We're going to put things in Verizon's like actual little, they're not data centers formally, at the base of the tower, there's servers and things like that. They were going to tie some Amazon services there. That way companies could basically have lower latency and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that was announced in 2019. Now Amazon and Verizon are actually really releasing things and people are using it. Amazon AWS Outpost services are now tied into Verizon Business's edge computing platform, and Corning is going to use it in their factories to handle their edge computing needs for self-driving vehicles and the robotics, which is actually pretty cool because a lot of this has been very theoretical for a while, and now we have use cases that are sort of real. I don't know how many self-driving vehicles Corning uses in its factories, but, you know, yay. The other news about Verizon that's worth mentioning is that they've finalized their plans to shut down their 3G cellular networks. And this is important for the IoT because lots of devices and gateways out there in the IoT actually use 3G radios. We've known this was coming, but Verizon said that they are going to shut their 3G network down at the end of 2022. Originally, this was like going to be like 2019, but people were very upset. Verizon kept extending it. They had announced it back in 2018. So we have definitely written about what happens at the end of the 3G networks. AT&T has also said that they're shutting down their network. That network is actually shutting down February of 2022. But and T-Mo is going to shut it down in January of 2022. I will say that I have a 3G modem in my car. So my Tesla has a AT&T 3G modem. So next February, I don't know what's going to happen.
Hopefully it's a modular design.
It is a modular design. I can replace it. But, you know, it's going to be a $500 upgrade or maybe more. Which, again, and we talk to people, you know, I have done stories on this before, and most of the companies that are actually using 3G radios in their products, they've been planning on this for a while because they signed these contracts way back with these companies. And the companies like T-Mobile, AT&T said, hey, yeah, we're going to support this for X number of years.
Right.
So the biggest issue actually with this is people like me. So it's people who are like, now I got to go upgrade, and they may be ignoring emails from their vendor that are like, hey, by the way, in a year, your gateway, your home security system is going to stop, you know, having backup access to the internet through 3G. You need to upgrade. So those things are going to happen. So be on the lookout for those emails, although Tesla still hasn't sent me one.
I hope they put a 5G module in your car at this point.
You know, those modules aren't great. If I'm going to go for a 5G module, I would probably wait until the last possible second, but that's just me. And a final note, just to put this all in perspective, there's actually still about 19% of the global, and this, you know, these are US networks that we're talking about, but the global cellular market, 19% of those connections are still 3G. They're falling, but there's still about 1.54 billion 3G connections at the end of 2020. So, that's telegeography data, by the way.
All those early IoT sensor devices that use cellular data, I'm sure they're all going to have to be replaced.
Oh, yeah.
Not just the radio, the devices, I have a feeling.
Oh, yes, the devices. Like, I've talked to ADT about this. I've talked to, I think, Vivint, maybe, or Alarm.com. I think it was Alarm.com. And they've been very proactively trying to incentivize their customers to upgrade. So as it gets closer, they'll have to be slightly more aggressive about it. So y'all can look forward to that. Okay, let's talk about hacks.
Oh, that's...
hey. All right. This is a newish story because of a judgment, but this is an older story. This happened in 2019. But y'all remember that Florida water treatment plant hack where the hacker, I'll use hacker in quotes, got in via TeamViewer, which is a remote access tool for industrial internet usage, right? So for monitoring systems. Basically, what happened is horribly lax security on the water treatment plant's part. It looks like that happened in Kansas in 2019. there was someone who was hired to actually upgrade the Ellsworth County Rural Water District's computer system. And he basically went in a little bit later and started messing with the chemical levels in the plant. And now he's been indicted for hacking the water system, and his charges carry a maximum prison sentence of 20 years and 5 years. So what we're looking at is this poor person. I shouldn't say poor person. This person.
No.
Well, so he's 22 now, which means he was working on this when he was 19. What 19-year-old is smart enough? Well, 19-year-olds, they're not.
They're curious. I understand that, but still.
And again, in this case, there wasn't ever a danger to the public because the control system in place monitors the water chemicals to make sure nothing gets out of whack. So it's an additional layer of security. But basically, what we're doing here is we don't actually talk about this enough. We talk about hackers and nation states, but we don't talk about employee access and ways to revoke and responsibly manage employee access to critical systems. And I say that both in the industrial space, but you even see it in things like Ring security cameras, when employees have access to kind of the God view, right? Mm-hmm. So when we talk about hacking, we think actual hacking and playing with code. Yeah, it was like playing with code or physical access to things. But what we're not thinking about is I had legitimate access, and because a company was just not careful enough, I continued to have it, or my password settings were shared among many employees, or just bad practices. We really need to focus on that. So
every system that is similar to this in terms of utilities or, is a public system, really ought to have at least like either the YubiKeys or some other two-factor authentication, quite honestly.
Yeah, I'm with you. And everybody should have their own individual passwords. And you should be very, very conscientious about revoking access to those when people are no longer employed there. Okay, let's get some news briefs in here. Madam A is going to your office. You might not be going to your office, but Madam A is. Amazon has announced knowledge skills for Madam A for Business. And basically what this is, you can build out templates called a knowledge skill, and it lets you teach Madam A things about your workplace, like where the conference rooms are or when big events are. How do you log into Wi-Fi? So we have these in our home. I know that I used to build a skill for like my babysitters, like how do I use the remote control? And Madam A would tell her. But now you can have people's directories. You can have how do I log into Wi-Fi? Where's the conference room? You could have it for events, like when is the keynote? So that's it.
Where's the bathroom and where's the food?
Yeah, give me food. All right, moving out of the office back into your home, IKEA is working with Sonos on a speaker built into your picture frames.
We're going to do the reverse here. I was actually kind of down on this, but now the more I think about it, the more I like it. We know that IKEA has its Symphonisk. Is that how I say it?
Symphonisk. I think like symphony, and then make it Nordic.
Okay. Well, whatever it's called, they have the bookshelf speakers, they have the table lamp with the speakers integrated, and it's a collaboration with Sonos. I really never looked into these because I don't need another lamp and I don't need bookshelf speakers. But if I could have the speaker integrated in with wall art, now I have a nice looking room when the TV is not on. When the TV is on, you don't see the speakers, but you can hear them. So I'm really intrigued by this.
Yeah, I'm all about, hiding functionality into other functionality.
Like masks. No, I'm just kidding.
No. Okay, maybe. All right. Google Home app is getting some new things. One, you're going to be able to control your Google Wi-Fi from it. So the Google Wi-Fi app is going away. It's going to become part of the Google Home app. They've added features to the Google Home app to make it feel more robust for Wi-Fi. So that shouldn't be terrible news. And then the Google Home app is also going to it's adding customizations to your feed, which, Kevin?
Yeah, I don't really use the recent events feed in Google Home that much. But for those who do, you kind of get inundated with a bunch of stuff that you probably don't care as much about. What is reportedly happening, and this is from a viewing of some upcoming code for the app, you're going to be able to customize those feed settings. So if you want to see all the Wi-Fi events, you can just see those. Or if you want to see camera events only, maybe you don't care about the door opening and closing all the time, you can remove that. So, not a major change, but I think it's welcome.
And now let us talk about the Wyze watch, Kevin, that you've been trying out. What do you think?
Okay, I'm probably going to catch a lot of heat for this because it is a $20 plus shipping and handling health tracker / smartwatch. But to me, it's not even worth the $20 for most people. I'm just going to come out right out front and say it. It's the Wyze strategy of a low-cost, basic product. But this is too basic to me. And I know I'm spoiled. I've tried a gazillion different smartwatches and trackers, and I currently wear an Apple Watch 6, which is 20 times more costly. But I find this watch, which looks like an Apple Watch on the outside, to be very laggy, to be very limited in what it can do. It doesn't connect to Wi-Fi, so you must have your phone connected to it via Bluetooth to get the data from it. Scrolling through the touchscreen, again, as I said, laggy. Battery life is fantastic. It's a good seven days, which is fantastic. But the reason it's so good on battery life is because it has so few features. It does have an accelerometer inside. It does have a sensor for heart rate and blood oxygen levels. I use those. I compare those to the Apple Watch and as well as some other devices that I have around the house. It's just not accurate in anything that's measuring by comparison. And the other devices that I have are much closer in terms of comparing. They're not ever going to be the same. But I mean, if I'm shortchanged 1,000 steps in a day with the Wyze watch, that's not great. If the heart rate is 10 beats less per minute, that's not great. I think if you are a Wyze smart home owner and you're all in on Wyze, because you can create up to 10 touch shortcuts to turn lights on or off or run an automation or send a video up to the cloud with your camera, then maybe. But for the health features, it's really more of the value is in trends, less in the data. It's just not that accurate. I said it best, I think, in my headline. It's a 2014 experience in 2021.
Yikes. What about voice? Can I use it to talk to things, control things with my voice?
You can certainly talk to this watch. It won't do a thing, though, because it doesn't have a microphone or speakers. So there's no digital assistant. It is completely reliant on the Wyze app on your phone. Completely. You can't even, if you walk around the house, you put your phone down and you go out of Bluetooth range, and you're wearing the Wyze watch and you hit a shortcut button, if it can't connect via Bluetooth to your phone in your own house, that's not going to happen. That shortcut won't take place.
Yeah, that would be terrible for me.
Yeah, no music, no installation of apps. You get what you get, which is very basic. Even the notifications. I mean, my messages from iMessage, they come through, but they're truncated. I can't respond to them, of course. And there's even like parsing errors. Like there's a space after every apostrophe. It's just feels like a knockoff watch.
Okay. Which it kind of is.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I know I wanted to like this for $20. I like almost every single other Wyze product, almost without question. This one is just not doing it for me.
Fair enough. You don't have to like everything. All right. Well, that concludes the news segment of the show. Let us now move into the IoT podcast hotline. This is the segment of the show where we answer your questions, and it is sponsored by Very. Very is a fully distributed IoT engineering firm that helps you get your biggest projects fully operational on time and on budget. And you can discover what Very's multidisciplinary teams can do for you at www.verypossible.com. Okay, so lots to do with this week's voicemail. We have got a winner for March. I do want to tell people that the April prize is going to be a smart speaker of your choice, as is our want. And our March winner is Danny. And actually, this week, Danny is also the person who asked our question. So, yay, Danny, you get both a smart speaker and an answer. Woohoo! If you would like to be entered to win, or just to have the chance for us to answer your question, give us a call at 512-623-7424, and you'll be entered for our April drawing, and we might answer your question. All right, so Danny, you had a good question, so let's hear it.
Hi, my name is Danny Roseberry out of Indiana. I was curious with projects like OpenHAB and Home Assistant, if equipment that's being depreciated from different companies, if those are still able to be used with those projects. Thank you very much for your time. Bye.
Okay, Danny, the answer to this is probably not in most cases. It's also a little bit of it depends. It depends on how a company implements their integrations with OpenHAB or Home Assistant. Most of them are going to do it via a call out to an API. And what happens is a company will deprecate its API and then it just won't work anymore for you. So that happened in the case of Nest, actually, when Google said, you know what? The way we're doing this is not secure. We don't like it. We don't have enough control. Let's change it. That broke everything. Now, if a platform has the ability for people to come in and kind of reverse engineer and build their own drivers, that happened a lot on SmartThings before they went from Groovy to where they are now, you will actually, after a period of time, people might find the API and kind of reverse engineer aspects of it. But that's becoming more and more difficult. It's not difficult, but companies are clamping down on it more, I guess I would say.
Well, the other problem is if I'm a developer and I decide I'm going to support some smart plug that the API is being deprecated for, I can create the API, but I also have to have a server to respond to that API, meaning I've got infrastructure that I need to pay for. So there's that whole aspect as well.
Yes. And so...
You know what I would do? Because this, I think this is a great question as we migrate away from hardware more into software for controlling the devices and such. We can't give a universal answer, and it's going to be a product-by-product basis. What I would do is look at the OpenHAB forums, look at the Home Assistant forums, look at the Samsung SmartThings forums, and see what developers who currently have, say, handlers or APIs for these things plan to do. Because they're pretty transparent. I mean, they're offering a service, and if they don't tell people about it, then why are they even bothering, right? Why are they spending the time to code it, host it, et cetera? I would look into the forums and see what people are doing and use that information to make my decisions in terms of what devices I might keep or replace.
Yes. And so I will say that being on OpenHAB or Home Assistant, those have incredibly robust developer communities. And developers who are frustrated with like SmartThings or more traditional, maybe mainstream user platforms, they tend to go there and spend their coding chops and working with these systems. So you're more likely to find someone who's willing to, I don't know, duct tape things together on those platforms.
These are typically people who have the same device as you do, and they rely on them, and they have the coding skills to keep them alive, essentially. And most of the effort is open source. They're not looking for money. They're not looking for recognition, but they're looking to keep their products alive, in which case you can kind of piggyback on them to keep your device alive, hopefully.
Until they don't. When they get rid of that device, you might be out of luck. All right. Well, Danny, congratulations and thank you for an excellent question. Please, if you guys want to be entered to win, give us a call at 512-623-7424. And that's about it for this segment of the show. So please stay tuned for our guest, Jennifer Ploskina of Eaton. We're going to be talking about basically turning your home into a little mini power plant. And you'll hear from this week's sponsor, DigiCert. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is DigiCert, which is a global provider of PKI and digital certificate management, which provides scalable identity authentication, encryption, and integrity for securing connected devices and users. And from DigiCert, I have Mike Nelson, who is the VP of IoT Security. First up, what are some of the biggest IoT security challenges that you see companies facing today?
Yeah, I think we see three common vulnerabilities across all IoT devices in different industries. And the first one is lack of authentication systems that are able to scale to meet the volume of devices that are being deployed. The second one is a lack of encryption of data. IoT devices are collecting data. A lot of that is confidential and it needs to be secured. And then the third vulnerability is around integrity. As manufacturers are sending updates to devices, making sure that firmware packages, code, any data has integrity associated with it.
And so why are manufacturers turning to public key infrastructure to solve some of those challenges?
DigiCert is the largest provider of public key infrastructure, or PKI, related products and services globally. And PKI really at its core is about leveraging digital certificates for things like certificate-based authentication, certificate-based encryption, using digital signatures to sign data to ensure that there's integrity associated with it. It's good for product security teams because it allows them to address those common vulnerabilities or core challenges that we've discussed.
So how does DigiCert help security teams implement scalable PKI for their products?
We work with organizations in the design and architecture stage to make sure that they're architecting the PKI in the right way. But we also have very robust products. DigiCert has built the IoT Device Manager on our DigiCert One platform to specifically address the growing challenges of using PKI within an IoT ecosystem. This manager is the most modern, flexible, and scalable PKI infrastructure on the market. As the number of connected devices grows for manufacturers and the device and certificate management challenge begins to increase, automation becomes so important for them. And our platform completely automates the entire lifecycle of certificates. Our platform is flexible. We can deploy on-premise or from the cloud. We can even host environments for our customers. The platform is also built upon a container-based and cloud-native architecture, which allows manufacturers not just to address the challenges that they're dealing with today, but also to look into the future and rest assured that they'll be able to meet those demands. I'm confident in saying that IoT Device Manager will allow any IoT manufacturer to rapidly deploy completely automated PKI in a variety of ways to meet all of the demands that they have within their organization.
All right, thanks, Mike. And where can we go to find out more information about DigiCert?
Yeah, your listeners can learn more about the IoT Device Manager by going to digicert.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Jennifer Ploskina, who is the Connected Solutions Segment Manager at Eaton. Hello, Jennifer. How are you today?
Hi, Stacey. I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
I am excited because one of my obsessions is actually what happens when we make the grid smarter, when we have the electrical grid can have that back and forth, just like we have with, you know, the internet, IP communication. So we're going to talk about that today. But first, I want to help people understand the perspective you're going to bring. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Eaton and what it is?
Sure. Eaton Corporation is a power management company. We supply solutions in the utility grid space down to industrial facilities, power distribution, motor control, software solutions, and then all the way down to commercial buildings and even residential. So a real easy solution that we have is the load center and the circuit breakers in your home.
Got it. And y'all actually just introduced we call her Madam A. It's Amazon's Echo, Amazon's digital assistant. Y'all just announced a connected Madam A powered light switch. So we're familiar with that. So let's get started with this idea that we're going to be both consuming power in our house, but we also might be generating it. There's the excitement about things like microgrids and neighborhoods and things like that. And what it means when our devices can kind of mediate their demands with the demands of the grid. So what is y'all's perspective on what y'all call the home as a grid?
Sure. It all starts with what we consider the energy transition, or really the global shift to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and create a more sustainable future for energy. And this could include adoption of electric vehicles, electrification of homes and buildings, like adding electric water heaters instead of gas-fueled heaters. So it really starts with that sustainability interest. And so as energy flows through the electrical grid in more directions through more devices than ever before, we have to think about how that increase in demand can be mitigated with things like behind the meter solar panels or battery storage or even electric vehicle batteries. We're looking at opportunities where we not only consume the power, but have the opportunity to generate power ourselves. And that's what we consider our home as a grid concept. So Eaton is working to build solutions for residential customers as well as utilities to benefit from these renewable technologies.
And we're talking a lot. Actually, I'm very excited because finally in 2021, we're hearing a lot about electrification tied to the home. So we're thinking about things like, hey, maybe there are legislation saying, hey, no more gas stoves in homes or gas fireplaces. We're also seeing it in cars, the need for an electric vehicle fleet. But I do worry that the demand on the grid, both in terms of
do we need more power plants? But also the demand on the home grid. Like, I don't know how many kilowatts come into my house, but that kind of upgrade is kind of intense. So talk to me about how we can, I guess, electrify without updating too much of our current infrastructure, or do we need to really invest there as well?
Yeah, in fact, that's the benefit of this home as a grid approach. So as your electricity demand increases with your EV charging and your electric appliances, we can build generating sources at the same time to offload some of that utility power that would have gone up. So that's the idea of allowing homes, buildings become their own grid, and you're really mitigating that higher demand over time.
So what are the challenges to implementing this? I feel like it's really exciting, but I'm also like, I don't have a battery stuck to my home. Well, I guess I have an electric car that you could suck from, but still.
Yeah, there are both technical and business challenges. Technically, when you're talking about bidirectional power flow, that's different than what we're used to, right, from the centralized grid. And so if homes or buildings are pushing power back to the grid, you have to think about how to do that safely. And then on the business side, we have to think about how can we collaborate with other partners in the space. It can be really complex. A lot of players at Eaton, we want to make sure that we're soliciting information, feedback from the market, as well as collaborating with partners like utilities, smart home ecosystem players, solar and battery storage installers, and equipment providers. So that collaboration piece is going to be key to make all of this work.
Okay, I want to go back to this bidirectional power flow issue from the tech side. What is the issue with bidirectional flows? And is this something that has like physical needs, like with the type of wiring? And then I think there's probably also a software layer that kind of can control what's using the electricity. I don't know.
Well, when you're putting power back onto the grid, you have to be careful about synchronizing with the utility power. So there is technical challenges to doing that. We actually have a product called the Energy Management Circuit Breaker that facilitates that bidirectional power flow, whether it's from solar, battery storage, or even your EV. So that's what's really important, the safety aspect, making sure you're synchronized with the utility power.
There are a lot of companies who have been interested in the past or are currently trying to, I guess, get into the what I think of the energy management in the home space. And this might be Microsoft, it might be Google, it could be like a new upstart. I'm very curious how you're thinking about both what Eaton has to offer here and then how you might work with them.
Yeah, we actually already partner with a number of these tech companies, Amazon, Alarm.com. And they actually look to us to provide the expertise around power management. So the circuit breakers in your home, the safety aspect, the cybersecurity aspect. So there are elements of collaboration across our longstanding power management company and the newer tech companies that seems to be working out really well.
How does this look when I try to put it in my house?
We have a product called the Energy Management Circuit Breaker that was built on the same form factor as breakers that exist today. So with a load center in your home, you can switch out a regular, what we call thermal magnetic or non-smart breaker with this smart breaker that can then be used to integrate a battery storage system, or if it's an EV, electric vehicle version, charging your vehicle and providing all the intelligence required to do that. And then as we partner with, say, a smart home ecosystem like Alexa, we pull data in and we share it through the app. And similarly, our wiring devices, our light switches, our receptacles, we use those for load control. And in the Alexa app, for instance, you can turn these devices on and off based on if you're running on storage at one point and you want to reduce some of your load. You could do that with our products as well.
I feel like that should ultimately be automated or something. Like I'm just thinking about like when my power goes out, it's usually kind of a crisis. So I'm like, I'm not automatically like, oh, yes, I need to go to the app and turn off this when the battery key, you know, starts up.
Yeah, I think as technology evolves, more and more automation. Right now, you can use schedules in your smart home system, right? You can set up if this, then that type of routines. But I think as technology evolves, especially with the backup power side, you're going to see more and more opportunity to automate how your power flows when the power goes out or something else happens.
I'm focused on when the power goes out, but there's also this idea of real-time pricing and changing what people pay based on the demand on the grid. And I think that's, we don't talk enough about that possibly. So I'd love to get your take on kind of how economics can drive incentives, or maybe it shouldn't. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, sure. You know, we talked earlier about the electricity demand increasing based on consumers and industry wanting to move towards low carbon fuel sources, right? So the idea that a utility wants to encourage keeping their overall demand low, one method of doing that is what's called time of use pricing or real-time pricing based on current demand levels. Well, with the concept of home as a grid, it does allow homeowners or even building owners for the larger buildings to manage their usage, their power usage, so that they're not getting into those higher electricity prices. And then with the bidirectional power flow, there's actually an opportunity to generate revenue by selling power back to the wholesale market. That's a whole other concept we haven't hit on yet, but economically, there are a couple of ways to help consumers save energy costs and actually bring in a new revenue stream.
Crazy. All right, let's move it out of the home and let's talk about the commercial environment. Maybe there's an opportunity for revenue there. Who knows? So what changes when we start talking about this in the context of commercial buildings or industrial buildings?
Yeah, one of the biggest use cases we found is going back to electric vehicle adoption. So like, for instance, in Europe, we just announced our buildings as a grid solution set, where we're offering the ability of a building owner to add in their EV charging stations, which increases electricity demand, right? But without having to upgrade their power infrastructure by using solar as a backup, battery storage, and then software to manage the whole system. If you think about it, it's exactly what we just talked about in the home situation, right? How do we make sure the grid isn't overloaded? Well, with solutions tied to the home as a grid or buildings as a grid, we really serve that market need.
One of the things that you keep talking about is, you know, this idea of generating your own power or creating a mini power station and possibly feeding that back into the grid. As a consumer, I have an electric vehicle, for example. So that feels like a battery that might go back into the grid, although I don't know if I really want that. Do you think that more people are going to be putting solar panels or adding batteries to their homes?
Yeah, we actually see market trends in that direction. And some of it is tied to regulatory areas like California, for instance. I believe it was their 2020 code, the CEC, that requires solar on all new builds tied to energy efficiency. And then again, with the new infrastructure package with the U.S. government in the U.S., we see more and more opportunity and trends that will increase that adoption rate.
I live in Seattle and it's just not sunny enough for solar. Ah,
that's right. And in fact, in California, there is an exception if you don't have good sun, which makes sense, right? It's all about, you know, using the sun to power your home.
That's good to know. Yes, I'm like, I wish I had good sun. Okay, let's talk about an issue that is also becoming more apparent, which is cybersecurity. As we connect our homes to utilities, and as we bring our utilities onto the internet, there's a lot of risks associated with that. And how are y'all working with both your products and your partners to help ensure that things are secure?
Yeah, you know, my job is connected solutions in residential and commercial markets. So we just inherently take cybersecurity as the most important aspect of what we do. So when we're looking at solutions for home as a grid, for instance, and communicating information across different networks, perhaps back to utilities, we see cybersecurity as the utmost importance. At Eaton, we've actually built out our own internal cybersecurity practice, and we partner with UL, which is the main code body that governs all of our products. We have several UL 2900 labs that support cybersecurity testing. And as we work with our partners, we have very strict protocols and processes to ensure that the data is protected, access is protected, and everything we do is safe and secure.
I look forward to that. And how do you think we'll pay for all of this? I mean, this is a lot of information going back and forth. It's unclear if I'm going to be like, I don't know if I really am that inspired to upgrade my electrical panels. So how does this get rolled out from an adoption perspective?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it depends on the individual and what they care about. What are their priorities? Are you in an area that loses power significantly or you know, enough times throughout the year that you want to make sure you have that backup power? You might be more interested in putting home as a grid solutions in place. If you have really great power quality and resiliency in your area, maybe not so much, but you might care about a new revenue stream. So you might say, I'm willing to invest X dollars to get back Y. So I think it really depends on the individual. And I also think that as technology, you know, evolves and improves and expands, you'll see a lot more affordability in solutions around solar and storage and making your home a real grid.
I cannot wait.
It is so exciting.
Okay. And so if I'm sold on this and I'm excited, it sounds like right now your products work with Amazon's ecosystem. Do they also work with Google's ecosystem or HomeKit?
Yeah. So as we develop smart solutions in this space, we take a pragmatic approach to our development. So our initial entree into the market with our Wi-Fi lighting, light switches and dimmers and receptacles is a frustration-free setup with Alexa, actually. And you mentioned earlier, our voice dimmer has Alexa built in. But then we also look at all the different ecosystems and develop integrations as we move along in the development cycle.
Got it. And I have high hopes for like projects like Connected Home over IP that might help standardize some of this. So maybe you won't have to do all that work.
Exactly. And that goes back to the collaboration piece. You know, Eaton is really committed to having an open platform, open collaboration in all of our solutions in the home as a grid or building as a grid space. So we really do hope to see more and more open systems so we can collaborate more fully to get the right products out there.
And what about standards? Obviously, when you want things to talk to each other at the utility, at the home, at the commercial setting, we should be talking about standards. And it's unclear to me what we should be looking at or for, like what standards might be important here and what we should seek to standardize when we talk about creating these grids.
Today, as you know, there are many different communication protocols, and some of it is proprietary and some portions of the home as a grid space. I think it is really important to consider more open standards. So you mentioned earlier the connected home over IP. We see that as an opportunity to create a more open standard for communication. We also, you know, going back to some of the regulatory requirements and standards and code to ensure safety and cybersecurity needs. We see that as extremely important. And, you know, Eaton being in the safety and security space our last, you know, 100 years or so, we feel pretty well positioned to support all the open standards and safety and security considerations.
Jennifer, thanks so much for coming on the show this week. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Stacey, so much for having me. We're really excited about the changes in the industry and the opportunities that they bring. Our home as a grid approach is really well positioned to support consumers, utilities, all of the solar and battery storage suppliers. And we look forward to all of that collaboration.
That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, if you'd like more IoT news, sign up for my newsletter at stacyoniot.com. We'll see you next week. Thank you.